Chapter 10, Inside Out. Since its inception in 1995, an exhibition of flayed, dismembered, and dissected human corpses has toured the globe, thanks to its now famous creator, the German anatomist Gunther von Hagens. Skinned, sliced, and drained of their fluids, these donor cadavers are plastinated with blood-bright silicones and flesh-hued polyesters, and carefully staged in a tableau of social activities. There are copulating bodies, wrestling bodies, singing bodies, gambling bodies, horse-riding bodies, chess-playing bodies, football-kicking bodies. Other corpses are more actively engaged in matters of life and death. There's a heavily pregnant body, the unborn child as viscerally exposed as its mother. A kneeling body performing CPR on a body collapsed on the floor. A gasping body wearing a firefighter's helmet and carrying in its arms a dried-up, lifeless skeleton. Each corpse is strategically stripped of its fat and flesh at key sites to reveal the muscles and organs nestled within its bony frame. Alongside the cadavers, internal organs are suspended in glass curiosity cabinets, pale, lumpy lengths of intestine stretched out like a rope for hanging, a pair of inflated lungs hovering overhead like a ghoulish bird, a bulbous heart frilled and frayed at its seams, dangling like a Halloween bauble. Turned inside out, the body becomes almost monstrous. And yet, like the best horror films, Body Worlds has proved irresistibly popular. With total attendance figures now estimated at over 44 million, the exhibition is classed by its creator as a form of edutainment, rendering the paying public privy to the secrets of the body hidden beneath the skin. Whether considered edifying, unethical, or grotesque, the ongoing success of Body Worlds is just the latest incarnation of an enduring human fascination for the inside of the body. The spectacle of the innards brings the strangeness of the body's internal organs to the surface in ways the flattened illustrations of medical textbooks can't, graphically revealing the realities of our insides, more usually experienced only as the sensations wrought by their activities: the rumble of an empty stomach, the gurgling of the intestines, the heaviness of a full bladder, the muffled thump of the heart. Exposing them renders the familiar strange, and the strange familiar. It was the very strangeness of the innards that gave birth to one of the world's oldest monsters. Known as both Huwawa and Humbaba, he was one of the most fearsome divine beings of ancient Mesopotamian mythology. Clothed with seven layers of divine radiance, with a belt around his waist, he had the body of a giant man, with thick bowed legs, a large flaccid penis, the paws and claws of a lion, and long straggly hair and whiskers. Most horrifying of all, he wore his guts on his face. In literary circles, Huwawa was well known as the guardian of the precious forest of cedars, a dwelling place of the gods located in what today is Lebanon. Appointed to this role by the high gods, Huwawa's terrifying appearance combined the mysterious powers of the internal organs with the animalized horrors of the wilderness. Indeed, he had the famously heroic Gilgamesh rooted to the spot when he and his devoted best friend Enkidu entered the forest of cedars on a quest for adventure and everlasting fame. Fear and terror spread through his sinews and feet. He could not move his feet on the ground, the big toenails of his feet stuck to the path. Huwawa's repulsiveness was designed to ward off even the boldest of intruders. Although Gilgamesh and Enkidu managed to defeat Huwawa by tricking him out of his protective auras, punching him in the face, and then cutting off his head, Huwawa enjoyed a long afterlife across Mesopotamia. Hundreds of terracotta plaques depicting his monstrous severed head were produced from the late 3rd millennium BCE and into the 1st. One of the most characterful examples, now displayed in the British Museum, was found in the ancient city of Sippar in southern Iraq. Huwawa's face is alive with tightly packed, lumpy coils of entrails. Like a flesh labyrinth, they twist and turn back on themselves, forming his cheeks and chin, his forehead and ears, and two rows of terrifying teeth set into a wide grimace, an iconographic constellation that would morph into the head of the Gorgon in Greek art. Some plaques were fixed as amulets to the walls of temples or suspended from doorways in homes, perpetuating Huawei's mythic role as a powerful guardian. But others were used as magical tools to decipher omens. Inscribed on the reverse with guidelines for interpretation, these clay images of Huawei's face were employed in a specialist branch of divination known as extispicy, by which the entrails of a sacrificial animal, usually a sheep, were examined for hidden messages from the gods. Comparing the shape and texture of the animal's intestines to Huawei's thick, fleshy coils enabled the diviner to discern what had been decided in the heavens. As both an agent of divination and the guardian of the divine forest of cedars, Huawei could guard or give access to the secrets of the gods. His gut-filled face manifested this gatekeeping role in the most visceral way. But the monstrosity of Huawei's face also embodied the very stuff of fear, a primal emotion which in ancient Southwest Asia was understood to be located not in the brain, but in the gut. Huawei was a product of a world in which the internal features of the torso embodied the more subjective aspects of experience. Fear and dread were overwhelmingly sensed in the intestines and most acutely felt in the discomfort and discharge of the bowels, reflecting in part an understanding that emotional upset and physical suffering were barely distinguishable. It's an understanding all too often minimized in the medicalized treatment of the body in the modern world, and yet instinctively reflected in the idioms of our everyday language. We're gutted by disappointment, shit ourselves with fear, and feel sick to our stomachs with worry. But fear was not the only emotion located and felt within the ancient Southwest Asian torso. For both gods and mortals, excitement, lust, and distress were also sited within the innards, or, more specifically, the liver and kidneys. In the lower belly, and especially the bowel and womb, the gut feelings of social bonding were sensed, the ache of sympathy, the warmth of compassion, and the burn of parental love. Emotions more closely tied to cognitive reflection and intellectual deliberation moved in and around the heart: regret, malice, satisfaction, grief, delight, frustration, ambition. Aspects of this ancient sensorium of the emotions are vividly glimpsed in descriptions of ancient Southwest Asian deities. As Anat of Ugarit revelled in the trampling of her enemies, her liver shook with laughter, her heart was filled with joy, the liver of Anat with triumph. When Marduk of Babylon became infuriated by social delinquency and religious neglect in his city, his whole body not only shook with anger, but his heart fumed, his liver raged. Like his divine elders, the God of the Bible experienced much of his emotional life as a sensory, physical transformation within his torso. An oracle in the book of Jeremiah is particularly visceral in its description of the intense emotions experienced by Yahweh. Dated to the early 6th century BCE, its setting is the Babylonian attack on Jerusalem and the destruction of the city's temple complex, described in traditional language as the tents and curtains of the deity. The disaster is engineered by Yahweh himself as a sorry punishment for the religious malpractice of his worshippers. But it will hurt him as well as them. My innards, I writhe in pain. Oh, the walls of my heart beats wildly, I cannot keep silent. I hear the sound of the trumpet, the alarm of war. Disaster overtakes disaster, the whole land is laid waste. Suddenly, my tents are destroyed, my curtains in a moment. The sensory anguish expressed in these verses is akin to the divine distress articulated by other ancient Southwest Asian deities, who physically lament the destruction of their cities and the desecration of their temples. They weep, they groan, they bend double. Their hearts race with grief-stricken rage or are weighed down with the heaviness of regret. And yet, most biblical translators and commentators have long preferred to hear in these words the voice of the prophet Jeremiah rather than the deity himself. After all, it's one thing for God to weep in anguish and cry out in pain, as he so often does in the Bible, but quite another to find him suffering belly cramps and heart palpitations brought on by emotional distress. But in the Bible, Yahweh's internal organs regularly manifest his shifting emotions. When freighted with grief, his heart sickens. When he mournfully sanctions the destruction of Moab, his innards groan and tremble. When he's moved to compassion for his beloved worshippers, his guts sonorously rumble. So familiar were some worshippers with the sensory workings of God's inner organs, his sudden somatic silence is cited as proof that he's physically abandoned them. Where is your zeal and your strength, the sounding of your innards, your compassion? They're restrained, his despairing people cry. Return for the sake of your servants. Tearful appeals like this, often staged within sacred space as ritual lamentation, were accompanied by the beating of chests and the mournful tones of drums and lyres. It was a practice long known to soothe the inflamed, enraged internal organs of the gods, and just as important to them as the daily ministrations of their priests. To be without specialists skilled in both praise and lamentation was to suffer dire neglect, as the bereft Sumerian goddess Gula complains. My lamentation expert no longer cools down my heart. My gudu priest, or cultic expert, no longer sings jubilations. Regular lamentation was so fundamental to the workings of a temple that in Mesopotamia, the lamenting musician, Gala, was given his own mythological origins. Equipped with a drum in his hand, the Gala was created by the clever god Enki, precisely to appease the wrathful heart of the fearsome goddess Inanna. He fashioned for her the Gala, the one whose lament soothes the heart. He arranged his tearful laments of supplication. The sound of these sacred drums not only echoed the lamenters' ritualized beating of their breasts, a widespread mourning action still employed today in grieving for the Jerusalem temple on Yom Kippur, but conceptually and audibly amplified the beating of the deity's heart, gradually bringing the thumping chests of worshippers and the deity into calmer, syncopated harmony. It was a multi-sensory transformation with which the God of the Bible would also find himself familiar. Biblical texts suggest that ritual drummers and professional lamenters were regular players in the cults of Yahweh and his divine assembly, with women skilled in lamentation performing a particularly prominent role in the ritual expression of religious grief. Call for the lamenting women to come. Send for the skilled women to come, God commands. Let them quickly raise a dirge over us so that our eyes may run down with tears and our eyelids flow with water. Painted terracotta figurines of high-status female drummers have been found in cultic contexts at sites across the southern Levant, including those of ancient Israel and Judah. Dating from the 8th to the 6th centuries BCE, Israelite and Judahite examples have tended to be interpreted as symbols of joyful celebration, but with their hand drums held closely to their chests, they're just as likely to represent some of the sacred lamenters called upon to soothe the hearts of Yahweh and the other gods. The ever-present threat of divine displeasure demanded the regular performance of ritual laments by religious professionals. But cultic lamentation was at its most urgent when the gods' raging hearts wrought punishment in the form of divine abandonment and earthly warfare. Both professional lamenters and royal mourners were hastily pressed into service to petition the gods for clemency and restoration. One such high-status petitionary was Adad-Guppi, the 104-year-old mother or grandmother of King Nabonidus of Babylon, who reigned 555 to 539 BCE. Her expertise in ritual mourning is memorialized in two inscribed stelae, both of which were found recycled as paving slabs in the steps leading to the Great Mosque of modern-day Harran in Turkey. The inscriptions reflect on the destruction of Harran's ancient predecessor in 609 BCE and naturally assume that the city had been given up to military attack by its angry deity, the moon god Sin, and his divine companions. As a lifelong devotee of Sin, Adad-Guppi sought to appease the god's anger and secure the rebuilding of his city. I was constantly beseeching Sin, she declares in the inscriptions. On her knees, she says, she gazed at him prayerfully and in humility, repeating the petitionary refrain, May your return to your city take place. Her whole body was her ritual instrument. In order to appease the heart of my God, I did not put on a garment of excellent wool, silver, gold, a fresh garment. I did not allow perfumes or fine oil to touch my body. I was clothed in a torn garment. My fabric was sackcloth. Adagupi's concentrated endeavours paid off. Sin's wrathful heart quietened down, and he returned to the city. As the language of the gods and their petitioners indicates, the soothing, cooling, and quietening of divine hearts was more than poetically figurative. Just as the ritual appeals of worshippers demanded the sensory engagement of their own bodies, so too the bodies of the gods were understood to respond with a visceral physicality. And the God of the Bible was no exception. When Assyrian forces threatened to overwhelm Yahweh's city of Samaria towards the end of the 8th century BCE, the cries of his worshippers moved him and his internal organs to mercy. "How can I give you up? How can I hand you over, O Israel?" he asks as he wonders whether to avert his impending punishment of his people. "My heart recoils within me," he continues, while a convulsion of compassion in his belly rises up warm. The sensation God experiences here is akin to that felt by the mother of the baby King Solomon famously threatens to carve in half, the gut-wrenching, lurching turn of a parent's innards, triggered by a deep seat of fear for their child. As God feels this same parental pain, the sensation spreads. The strong emotional impulses within his lower abdomen reach up into the cavity of his chest, causing his heart to turn about its decision. Physically, rather than simply metaphorically, the God of the Bible feels a change of heart. For both humans and deities, this upward anatomical movement was the corporeal process by which feeling also became thinking. "It did not ascend to my heart," God says, when he claims in the Bible, with some frequency, that a certain idea had not occurred to him. His heart was the body part in which his passions and plans were fused and fleshed, and in this he was no different from any other deity, nor indeed any mortal. Across the cultures of ancient Southwest Asia, the heart was a cognitive organ. It was the site of reason and deliberation, decision-making and action-taking. But it might easily be changed by an uprising of belly-based emotion. And within the divine realm, the consequences of such a change of heart could be devastating. Yahweh regretted that he had made man on the earth, and there was pain in his heart. So Yahweh said, "I will wash from the earth the man I created, both man and beast, creeping things and birds of the air, for I regret that I made them." The palpable, corporeal nature of the Bible's ancient language of the heart is often missed by modern-day Western readers, for whom the emotional, thinking heart is rather more emblematic than solidly somatic. Although we might read the changing rhythms of the heart as a gauge of shifting emotion, it serves only symbolically as a sensing, thinking organ. Meanwhile, our thoughts are to be found in our heads, caught somewhere between the neurological activities within the lobes of our brains and the more nebulous psychological dynamics of our minds, whatever it is that the mind might be. By contrast, in ancient Southwest Asia, it was the heart that sensed and made sense of the world beyond the body. Just as the eyes see and the ears hear, as Moses is said to tell the Israelites, so the heart understands. Conscious thought was quite literally organic. It was a fleshy, feeling part of the inner anatomy. In the Bible's story world, the perpetual motion and sound of the living heart signalled its fleshy malleability, which in turn textured the quality and worth of its thoughts. A hardened heart was impenetrable and impervious to change. A fat heart was sated of space and dulled in sense, leaving no room for increased understanding. A melting heart was unstable in form, incapable of holding reason and intention within its walls. Like an otherworldly Goldilocks, Yahweh preferred the human heart to be neither too firm, too full, nor too soft. Instead, it was to be just right. A heart after my own, he says, in form and function. A heart of flesh to be saturated with religious knowledge and understanding. Those special individuals equipped with such hearts were usually the monarchs divinely ordained to lead Yahweh's people as a shepherd, an exalted ritual title commonly used of kings throughout ancient Southwest Asia and literalized in the biblical story of the rise of David from sheepherder to king. But Yahweh was not alone in correlating the hearts of his royal shepherds with his own. In 539 BCE, the Persian king Cyrus II conquered the ancient city of Babylon, incorporating its sizable territories into his own to create a vast empire. At its eastern edges, it reached as far as the Himalayas. Westwards, the new empire encircled the Mediterranean from Thrace in Greece down to Memphis in Egypt. Such a seismic reordering of the world could only have been achieved by a king in possession of a divinely aligned heart. And this is exactly what Cyrus himself claimed. To commemorate his victory over Babylon, he commissioned the inscription adorning the famous Cyrus cylinder, copies of which were circulated to his new vassals. In this inscription, Cyrus cast himself not as the foreign aggressor, but as the rightful liberator of Babylon, specially selected by the mighty Babylonian god Marduk to free his city from the destructive rule of its indigenous rulers and to restore the angry god to the capital he had abandoned. Cyrus claims that Marduk scrutinized the innards of mortals to find the man whose heart matched the urgings of his own. All through the lands together he searched out, tested, and looked for an upright ruler who matched the urgings of his own heart. He called out his name, Cyrus, king of Anshan. He pronounced his name to be king over all the world. And Cyrus shepherded with justice and righteousness all the black-headed people over whom Marduk had given him victory. Yahweh, too, appears to have felt the same urgings of the heart as Marduk. In a collection of oracles delivered shortly after Cyrus's capture of Babylon, and now found in the book of Isaiah, Yahweh claims it was he himself who had called out Cyrus's name, appointing him as the shepherd, the king who would fulfill all the delights and intentions of God's heart. Yahweh designates Cyrus his Messiah, or anointed one, who will subdue the nations, rebuild Jerusalem, return his displaced people to the city, and restore his temple. This prophetic interpretation of wider political events became so central to subsequent reflections on the rebuilding of the Jerusalem temple that Cyrus is even given the last word in the Tanakh. At the very end of 2 Chronicles, which closes the Jewish Bible, Cyrus declares, Yahweh, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth and has charged me with building him a house in Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Whoever is among you of all his people, may Yahweh his God be with him. Let him go up to worship in Jerusalem. Marduk and Yahweh might have been long-term rivals in the territorial politics of the earthly realm, but in the mythological world, their hearts were cannily aligned when it came to the great King Cyrus. For both deities, the scrutinizing of human hearts was a process akin to divination. With piercing supersight, the gods could not only peer into the hearts of worthy rulers, but examine the hearts of the disobedient. When Yahweh decides to flood the world to rid it of mortals, it's because he sees that the inclination of the thoughts of their hearts is evil. Like a diviner skilled in extispicy, he was well known to scrutinize the innards of his worshippers to discover their desires and principles and judge them accordingly. He's called the tester of hearts and entrails, and the God who seeks an oracle in every heart and understands every plan and intention. It's probably for this reason that in Exodus 28, Yahweh's high priest is commanded to wear a chest covering over his heart, known as the Hoshen Mishpat, or breastpiece of decision. Crafted with expensive blue, purple, and crimson fabrics and embellished with gold, the breastpiece is filled or studded with 12 precious stones, each inscribed with the name of one of the tribes of Israel. This chest covering appears to have been a part of the high priest's divinatory toolkit, along with divine lots known as Urim and Thummim, which were kept inside its pocket. The Urim and Thummim were used to divine the will of the deity, a key function of a priest who was appointed by Yahweh to do according to what is in my heart. In ritual exchange, the stones on the breastpiece likely facilitated Yahweh's divinatory reading of the high priest's heart in his role as the cultic intermediary and representative of the deity's worshippers. By wearing these stones in the breastpiece of decision on his heart when he goes into the holy place, the high priest shall carry the instrument of decision for the Israelites over his heart in the presence of Yahweh at all times. For some early Christian writers, the mediatory and divinatory skills of the high priest were pointedly usurped by Jesus. In John's Gospel, the divine Son of God is the only one who can communicate God's intentions because he is close to the Father's heart. Meanwhile, God's own divination of human hearts had inevitably become a skill attributed to Christ. In the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, Jesus reveals that he can perceive the thoughts of his opponents when he asks them, "Why do you think evil in your hearts?" In the book of Revelation, the divine nature of this skill is rendered even more explicit when the Son of God claims, "I am the one who searches kidneys and hearts." It was the age-old ability of the gods to read the hearts of mortals that also underlay early Christian confessions of faith. As Paul wrote in his letter to Jesus devotees in Rome, it was not enough simply to proclaim faith in Jesus Christ. Believers also had to know it, to think it, in their hearts, in order to attain eternal salvation. If you confess with your mouth that Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. For Paul, believing in your heart that Jesus resurrected was not a leap of unthinking faith, but a reasoned decision. If thinking was an act of the heart, wisdom was hefted within its chambers. The old biblical proverb that wisdom is at home in the heart of one who has understanding was a physiological truism of its time. The legendary King Solomon, famed in the Bible for his wisdom, was said to have asked God for a listening heart and was granted very great wisdom, discernment, and breadth of heart as vast as the sand on the seashore. He was wiser than anyone else. But the hearts of gods, of course, were wider and wiser. Stored within them was not only the worldly wisdom humans might hope to acquire, but the distinctive form of wisdom with which the cosmos itself was brought into order. Exclusive, elusive, and all-encompassing, it was divine wisdom. A lengthy Sumerian hymn of praise illustrates well the dizzying breadths and depths of the wise hearts of the gods. It's attributed to the earliest author we're lucky enough to know by name, Enheduanna, a woman whose remarkable literary legacy is all too often eclipsed by that better-known female poet of antiquity, Sappho. Writing over a millennium and a half before Sappho, Enheduanna was the daughter of the powerful king Sargon of Akkad, circa 2334 to 2279 BCE. He appointed her high priestess of the moon god Nanna, also known as Sin, at the city of Ur. She wrote and compiled a number of religious texts praising various deities in their temples, but her collection of hymns to the goddess Inanna are particularly remarkable for their literary artistry and deeply personal religious passion. In the first of these, Enheduanna pointedly addresses the wise goddess as Lady of the Largest Heart and crafts a richly textured portrait of Inanna as the magnificent lady who gathers up the divine powers of heaven and earth. For Enheduanna, Inanna is a deity so powerful that her divinity surpasses that of even the highest gods, An and Enlil, who have willingly ceded their wisdom to her. "In your vast wisdom amongst all the gods, you alone are majestic," Enheduanna exclaims. In this poem, Inanna not only governs the forms of wisdom graciously bestowed upon mortals, such as expertise in warfare, ritual, economics, sex, and medicine, but curates and controls the divine wisdom underpinning the very foundations of the cosmos. To destroy, to create, to cut apart, to establish Inanna are yours. To turn a man into a woman and a woman into a man, Inanna, are yours. A large and expansive heart, Inanna, are yours. Almost 2,000 years later, another poet was crediting just one deity with the wisdom to create and destroy. And for him, it was Yahweh. For the writer of the Book of Job, creation and destruction were precisely the aspects of divine wisdom hidden in the heart of Yahweh and shared with no other divine being. Not even the primordial gods of the cosmos, who continue to play such a crucial role in the structuring and maintenance of the universe, had access to his wisdom. "It's not in me," says ancient Tehom, deep. "It's not with me," states Yam, or sea. "We have heard only a rumour of it with our ears," claim Avadon, destroyer, and Mot, death. The creative results of divine wisdom were evident in the shape and workings of the cosmos, but the power to hold that wisdom in the heart was Yahweh's alone. It was a view shared by other biblical writers. In the book of Jeremiah, Yahweh is described as the God who built all three tiers of the cosmos. "It is he who made the underworld by his power, who established the earthly world by his wisdom, and by his understanding stretched out the heavens." As if to emphasize the exclusivity of Yahweh's cosmological wisdom, a later hand, writing in Aramaic rather than Hebrew, has inserted a helpful preface to this verse. "The gods who did not make the heavens and the earth shall perish from the earth and from under the heavens." The wise and secret heart of Yahweh would continue to be used as proof of his cosmic supremacy. Among the Dead Sea Scrolls, an unusual version of the Book of Psalms was found to contain a hymn celebrating the creation of the cosmos by a notably corporeal Yahweh equipped with a knowing heart. "Kindness and truth are around his face. Truth, uprightness, and justice are at the base of his throne. He separated light from darkness. The dawn he established with the knowledge of his heart. Then all his angels saw and sang, for he showed them what they had not known." It was the emphatically exclusive character of divine wisdom that had always distinguished it from the wisdom of mortals. While the wisest men of the legendary past, like Solomon, might have amassed the specialist knowledge of earthly wisdom beyond bounds, their wise hearts were by no means akin to those of the gods, and to assume otherwise was deadly. In the 6th century BCE, this is exactly what Yahweh tells an anonymous king in the book of Ezekiel. In a sharp-tongued attack, he condemns to death the king who is so wise of heart he presumes himself a god and claims Yahweh's throne as his own. "You have said, 'I am a god, I sit in the seat of the gods.' Because you compare your heart with the heart of a god, I will therefore bring strangers against you, the most terrible of the nations. They shall thrust you down to the pit, and you shall die a violent death. Will you still say, 'I am a god,' in the presence of those who kill you?" Spitting with sarcasm, this stinging oracle draws on a much older, possibly pre-biblical myth about the privileged ritual ascent of a king into the heavenly sphere, from where he can be expelled by a divine decree should he offend the gods. Further features of the myth are found in a second, closely related oracle in Ezekiel, in which the source of the king's wisdom is indeed revealed to be none other than the heavenly realm. "You were in Eden, the garden of the gods," Yahweh says to him, "full of wisdom and perfect in beauty." These qualities are represented by the divinatory breastplate, elsewhere associated with the high priest, covering the king's chest. But the breastplate serves its purpose, revealing that the king's wise heart has become fatally tarnished. "Your heart was proud because of your beauty. You corrupted your wisdom because of your splendor." He's cast out of Eden and into the earthly realm, where he's killed and consigned to the underworld. The lesson in these oracles is as transparent as the fallen king's heart. Wisdom and immortality are defining characteristics of divinity, and no mortal should seek or claim to possess both. A century or so later, in the 5th century BCE, the myth was again reworked, this time into its better-known form, now found in the story of Eden in Genesis chapters 2 to 3. In this version, the privileged king of old has been replaced by the primal man, Adam. But wisdom is deliberately kept from him and his wife while they dwell in God's garden. It's held at arm's reach, locked within the fruit of the tree, desires to make one wise, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. A mysterious second tree in the garden holds in its fruits the potential to live forever. Both trees are strictly off limits. But it's a divine prohibition the man and woman famously ignore. Eating from the first tree, they consume wisdom and become like gods. Fearing they will now eat from the other tree and taste the fruit of immortality, God expels them from the heavenly garden to a life of earthly mortality. It's a story so well known that it often goes unnoticed that stealing wisdom is not the only crime committed in Eden. Adam and Eve are also guilty of illegally consuming sacred food, carefully cultivated produce that's not to be eaten by humans, but is to be set apart for the gods. This was as serious a misdemeanor as disobedience, and the resulting punishment fits the crime. With visceral precision, God targets the bellies of Eden's criminals. The man will have to work unyielding, cursed earth to fill his stomach, rather than tending the divinely fertile garden. The woman will feel pain in her abdomen in birthing children, but a perpetual appetite for her husband in her loins. Deprived of his wings, not his legs, the serpent will be forced to crawl on the ground on his belly, swallowing dust as he goes. Eden's serpent is best understood as one of the seraphim, the winged guardian serpents who fly about the divine throne in Isaiah 6. It was common knowledge across ancient Southwest Asia that when it came to their food, the gods could be ferociously possessive, exceptionally picky, and woefully unforgiving of any culinary calamities. The God of the Bible was no different.